Thank you, Brother Chris. Good morning, brethren. Before I begin my discourse, I'd like to address an issue that came up last Sunday. If you remember, for the morning devotional service, I had asked a sister to open with prayer. And after the meeting, a couple of brethren came to me upset that I didn't use a brother for prayer. And I'm assuming since two brethren came to me, there are probably more of you who might feel the same way, that we shouldn't use sisters to open our meetings with prayer. And so I'd like to spend just a few minutes on that point, which is totally unrelated to my discourse. I believe it's important for us to differentiate between tradition and what the scriptures teach. I think traditions can be good, but obviously they should never be taken over inspired testimony. I think the confusion comes in our mind when we consider Paul's statement in 1 Corinthians 14:34. One more slide. Paul said that women should keep silence in the church. Well, let me just say that last week I never even thought that this would be a controversy. I never really put a lot of thought into it. I just thought I would call on someone who I thought would give a nice prayer. But I think this scripture confuses us a little bit. Let me read a statement by Brother Russell on reprint 227 where he discusses this very verse. He says, when Paul said, let the women keep silent in the congregations, he probably had reference to the public gatherings at which it was the custom to have more or less of a debate. In these public debatings, Paul thought a woman's voice would be out of place. And this is the opinion of most thinking men and women today, though we think that it has been carried to an extreme, forbidding them to pray or teach on any occasion, even in more private assemblies of Christians. And this we regard as an error. And then on page 268 of volume 6, Brother Russell comments further on that text. He says, the apostles' restrictions evidently related to the meetings such as described in 1 Corinthians 14. These meetings included sisters who certainly shared all of its blessings, joining in the songs and hymns and spiritual songs and in the prayers by whomsoever offered. Now, Brother Russell is making the point that Paul's restriction itself is limited and should not be carried to an extreme. I think sometimes our traditions have carried that to an extreme. Offering prayers at a meeting is one of the privileges that sisters are free to join in on, as long as they have their heads covered and they're in the right frame of mind, not trying to usurp authority. One more text before we stop talking about that. 1 Corinthians 11:5. The Apostle Paul wrote, every woman that prayeth or prophesieth with her head uncovered dishonoreth her head. Brother Russell comments on that verse in the 6th volume, page 272. He says, we suggest the most liberal interpretation possible should be given to the inspired apostle's words, respecting the scope of liberty of the sisters in the affairs of the church. Our judgment of this we set forth thus. Number one, sisters have the same liberty as the brothers in voting for class servants. And number two, sisters cannot serve as elders or teachers in the church. This, however, need not be understood to hinder the sisters from participating in meetings, not of the teaching or preaching kind, such as prayers and testimony meetings, Berean studies, and so forth, because the Apostle Paul said that if she pray or prophesy, that is speak, it should be with her head covered, representing her acknowledgement of the fact that the Lord, the great teacher, is specifically represented by the brethren or by the brothers. So, brethren, please distinguish in your mind the difference between traditional practices and those which are scripturally authorized. We are well within our scriptural bounds of the ecclesial arrangements when sisters are asked to pray, even on Sunday. And I think we have some pretty solid authority to base that on. So that's all I'll say on that subject. I did never intended to bring up a controversy. I just think it needed to be addressed. If someone would like to discuss that with me further, I would be glad to hear your comments. So let's move on to our subject. Looking back to Sodom. The story of Sodom and Gomorrah is one I'm sure we're all familiar with. It's found in Genesis, the 18th and 19th chapters. In Genesis, the 13th chapter, remember that a conflict had arisen between the herdsmen of Abraham and the herdsmen of his nephew Lot. Because Abraham wanted to keep peace between their families and their contingencies, he suggested to Lot that they part company. He said to Lot, if thou wilt take the left hand, then I will go to the right, or if thou depart to the right hand, then I will go to the left. So Abraham gave Lot the first choice of where to live. And when Lot looked at the choices, of course, he chose the Jordan Valley. In Genesis 13:3, we're told that Lot dwelt in the cities of the plain and pitched his tent towards Sodom. But the men of Sodom were wicked and sinners before the Lord exceedingly. Now, to the natural eye, Lot chose the best land for his flocks to graze when he chose the Jordan Valleys. The scriptures describe the Jordan Valley as the garden of the Lord. It was lush and green like the paradise of the Garden of Eden. Probably not quite as good, but that was the comparison that was being made. After Lot settled there, he had some harsh experiences with being taken captive and Abraham having to rescue him and so forth. And then finally three angels came to Abraham, first to announce the birth of Isaac, but then to let him know what was going to happen with the cities of the plain, with Sodom and Gomorrah. In Genesis 18:17, we get an insight into the thinking of God and how he viewed his relationship with Abraham. It says, and the Lord said, shall I hide this from Abraham, that thing which I do? Seeing that Abraham shall surely become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him. Well, the Lord felt that he owed an explanation to Abraham regarding the impending destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. God knew that Abraham would be affected by what God was going to do in those cities. And so he wanted Abraham to understand not just what he was going to do, but why he was going to do it. The reasoning of the Lord here is very similar to how he has dealt with the church in the harvest of the gospel age. Just one second. Question comes up, why has the Lord revealed to us the time of trouble? Why has he detailed the destructive process that the world is experiencing and that will culminate in the Battle of Armageddon? Well, the answer is the same reason he revealed the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah to Abraham, because we are affected by it, so that we can be prepared and understand the reasons he is doing these things. And, of course, he wants us to stay away from Sodom, just like he wanted Abraham to stay away. Jesus said, I have called you friends, for all things that I have heard of my Father I have made known unto you. That's the principle. He lets his people know what they need to know when he's doing something like that. Genesis 18:21 is also an interesting verse. Here we have the angel of the Lord saying, I will go down now, he's saying this to Abraham, and see whether they have done altogether according to the cry of it which has come unto me. And if not, I will know. In other words, he's saying, I'm going to go to Sodom to see for myself if everything I've heard about the evil of Sodom is true. Now think about that. Why would the angel of the Lord have to ask that or say that or go down and find out for himself? Exactly. He knew exactly what the evil was being done in Sodom and Gomorrah. Why did he and another angel have to actually travel there to see it? Well, obviously the whole scene, the whole interchange was done for the benefit of the few righteous people so that they would understand the justice of Sodom's destruction. We see that sense of justice come up immediately in Abraham's mind when he hears about what's going to happen. He says to the Lord in verse 24, Lord, if there be 50 righteous in Sodom, will you not destroy it for those 50's sake? Then right away in the next verse, 25, he says, shall not the judge of all the earth do right? Abraham had an inner sense of justice, and the Lord respected that, because obviously the Lord loves justice too. But he wanted Abraham to understand that the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah was a just and righteous sentence. When we look at the world today, when we look at the church systems, the governments, we too have to understand that their destruction is a just and necessary work. We have to understand that Armageddon, though it will be a fearful time, will be for the benefit of mankind. Yes, there will be pain and suffering, but the end result will be the healing of the nations. That is worth the trouble and the pain. Only when we appreciate the justness of the time of trouble can we realize that we as Christians should not be involved in the political and social reforms of society, not because we don't want reform, but because we understand the judgments of the Lord, that the old wineskin just can't be fixed, it has to be replaced. And what it's going to be replaced with will be so much greater than any government or organization that mankind can devise. In the discussion between God and Abraham, Abraham asked, if there were 50, then the city should not be destroyed. Then he takes it down to 45, and then 40, and then 30, and then 20. And finally, Lord, if there are only 10 righteous, will you not destroy Sodom? This is what Brother Russell says about the character of Abraham. Reprint 38:57. He says, it is to his credit that he was unwilling to think of those people as badly as they deserved. Benevolent people generally are pretty sure to err in their judgment on the favorable side when they think of the weaknesses and villainies of their neighbors. Well, brethren, here's a little test for you. If you were in Abraham's place, what would you have said if the angel told you that this evil and wicked city that might be corrupting your family, a part of your family, was going to be destroyed? Would you throw up your hands and say, great, they're getting just what they deserve? Or would you be more like Abraham? How do you look at the sinful world around you today? I think that Abraham would have looked at the world today through kind and loving eyes, that he would be more willing to err on the benevolent side. The Lord would much rather have his people be of this generous type, people who are grieved by the sins of others, and who would rather see the destruction averted if possible. How appropriate is it for Abraham, the father of faith, the receiver of the great promise, the great role model that we all look up to have that benevolence as such a fundamental part of his character. In Genesis, the 19th chapter, we finally see the angels enter Sodom, where immediately they meet Lot. It's interesting that Lot is almost as generous and gracious as Abraham had been to those same angels. Lot bows to them. He implores them to come to his home. They said, no, we'll just stay in the city, sleep on the streets. And he dragged them to his house. And then he prepared them a great feast. Very reminiscent of what Abraham had done earlier to the same angels. Now, maybe this attitude of hospitality comes from the simple lifestyle of a shepherd. You know, living in the rugged conditions of the mountains and wilderness areas, both Abraham and Lot knew that there were inherent dangers in open country. And so strangers were at a great disadvantage when they were traveled. And I'm sure these angels didn't look like they had a whole pack mule of support behind them. They were just three men walking by themselves. On the other hand, city dwellers were in a much safer environment, and so they didn't have that same concern for strangers and travelers, especially in a place like Sodom. You know, I think this city mentality is true for the most part in our society today. There is a coldness. There is a distance between people in large cities. If you take a walk in downtown Chicago, you will see very little eye contact being made between people, very little expression on the faces of people as they go hurrying past one another. Of course, that happens largely because the people who are walking past each other don't know each other. So it's kind of a self-preservation mechanism. But brethren, someday society isn't going to be like that. Someday people will walk down the streets of a city like Chicago and they will know everyone they meet. You ever gone downtown Chicago on a Monday morning when everyone is rushing to work back? And there's thousands of people. And if you know one face in the crowd, you're really hitting it good. Imagine a society where all those thousands of people know each other and love each other and trust each other. And they want to express their warmth to each other. I can imagine no one will ever get anywhere on time because they'll be so involved in interacting with the people they see every day. Just imagine the streets of the cities of Chicago and New York and Paris and all the cities everywhere in the world filled with that type of interaction and love one for another. That's why man's governments have to go, because they cannot create that type of society. Because of the fall in sin and selfishness, the world that man has created is sterile in a cold society that we have today. In 2 Peter 2, verse 7 and 8, the apostle calls Lot just and righteous. Those verses read, "And God delivered just Lot, vexed with the filthy conversation of the wicked. For that righteous man dwelling among them in seeing and hearing vexed his righteous soul from day to day with their unlawful deeds." Now that question that came up in my mind is, if Lot was so righteous and just, and the wickedness of Sodom vexed him so much, why did he live there? Why didn't he follow the example of his uncle and stay away? On reprint 3939, Brother Russell talks about the time when Lot went with Abraham into Egypt. And he concludes after some discussion that seeing the worldliness of Egypt may have affected Lot tremendously. He then asks, what was Lot's real failure? And he answers by saying, apparently it was his worldly mindedness, probably his desire to please his wife and his daughters. He should have decided that their moral interests were far above all others and should have marked his course accordingly. Brother Russell then draws a lesson by saying, what we do urge is that all the Lord's people, the Lord's true people, should seek first, primarily, the will of the Lord, his righteousness, his service, the things that would make for their peace and their everlasting blessing, rather than the things of time and sense and ease and worldly pleasure. Brethren, that's difficult to do, isn't it? To choose spiritual things, things that you cannot see, over temporal things that please the natural senses. It's especially difficult to do when those around you are not doing it. When we associate with people whose goals in life are worldly, how can we not be affected by that? How can we seek spirituality if we don't spend time with spiritual people? It was a shame that Lot could not stay with Abraham and be surrounded by the atmosphere that Abraham created. Obviously, Lot did not value the presence of Abraham enough. Had he done so, I think his choice of where to live and where to bring his family would have been very different. As Lot entertained his guests, we see the citizens of Sodom showing the wickedness of their hearts. This is Genesis 19, verses 4 through 8. It says, "But before they lay down, the men of the city, even the men of Sodom, compassed the house around, both old and young, all the people, from every quarter. And they called unto Lot and said unto him, where are the men which came into thee this night? Bring them out unto us, that we may know them. And Lot went out at the door unto them, and shut the door after him, and said, I pray you, brethren, do not so wickedly. Behold, now I have two daughters which have not known man. Let me, I pray you, bring them out unto you, and do ye to them as is good in your eyes. Only unto these men do nothing, for therefore came they under the shadow of my roof." Now there's been some debate regarding what the men of the city wanted to do with the angels, but in my mind it's not much of a debate. It seems apparent by what they say and by the Lord's disgust with their perversity that homosexuality was one of the abominations of Sodom, and that they were desiring to commit with the angels. We get a clue of that in Jude, the 7th verse. It says, "Even as Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities about them in like manner giving themselves over to fornication and going after strange flesh are set forth as an example, suffering the vengeance of eternal fire." So this going after strange flesh and wanting to know the men who were Lot's guests all suggests their homosexual desires here. This is one of those sins that is strictly forbidden in the Mosaic Law. Leviticus 20:13, it says, "If a man also lie with mankind as he lieth with a woman, both of them have committed an abomination. They shall surely be put to death. Their blood shall be upon them." And then again, the Apostle Paul condemns it very clearly in Romans 1:26 and 27. He says, "For this cause God gave them up unto vile affections, for even their women did change the natural use into that which is against nature. And likewise also the men, leaving the natural use of the woman, burned in their lust one towards another, men with men, working that which is unseemly, and receiving in themselves that recompense of their error which was meet." The scriptures are very clear that homosexuality is sinful. When Lot was standing at the door of his home trying to convince the men of Sodom to leave his guests alone, he makes a very strange offer. In Genesis 19:8, he offers the men his two virgin daughters. And he says, "Do ye to them as is good in your eyes, only unto these men do nothing." Brethren, I have to tell you, I missed a page. Oh, you're right. Thank you. Oh, I missed a whole scripture here. Okay, I will go back to that. Okay, get back to one of the arguments that maybe the world might use on our scriptural view of homosexuality. The argument might be made that the scriptures are the Christian's standard and they don't apply to the world of mankind. But back in that Romans text, notice what Paul says in verse 28, the very next verse from the one we quoted. He said, "And as they did not choose to possess the knowledge of God, God delivered them over to a worthless mind to do improper things, abounding in every iniquity." So the question comes, does the world have a right to sin? And the answer is no. No one has a right to sin. Adam and Eve did not have a right to sin. That's like asking, does someone have a right to break the law? Do they have the freedom to sin? Ah, there's the difference. Yes, God gives them the freedom to sin. It comes with free moral agency. But those who practice sin do so to their own detriment. Paul's point is that by sinning, they are choosing not to make God a part of their lives. So does that mean that we go out and campaign against this sin and all the sins that the world commits around us? The answer is simply that is not our job. We are called to be sanctified, separated from the world, not to try and reform it. Someday those reforms will come in the kingdom, but for us to be involved in the social issues around us would take us away from what God would have us do. Abraham is our pattern here. He avoided the sinful cities of the Jordan Valley, and he stayed in the more isolated regions where he could tend his flock and raise his family. But he knew that it was wrong for him and his family to go to those sinful places. So back into Sodom. What Lot suggested to the men who wanted to take the angels, that says, "Do to them as is good in your eyes, only unto these men do nothing." He was offering his daughters to this mob. I have to tell you that floored me. What father in his right mind would have offered his two virgin daughters to a mob of men like this? It's almost incomprehensible that a just man like Lot would do that. What was he thinking? Now, there's no question that Lot should have tried to protect the angels, but not by offering the mob his two daughters. And the point here is that Lot had unwittingly put himself and his family in this compromising situation by coming to Sodom in the first place. I doubt that he ever envisioned this scenario taking place when he first decided to move there, but it happened because he compromised the standard of sanctification, of being apart, that Abraham lived by. The Lord was merciful to Lot. We see that over and over again in his life. In verse 10, the angel takes over the situation and he controls the men outside by striking them with blindness. What a simple resolution to a dilemma that only moments earlier was getting out of control and that Lot didn't know what to do. It could have led to awful results for Lot and his family. So we see how gracious the Lord is in the way he can resolve the seemingly impossible situation that his people can get themselves into. Check my page numbers now. Okay. You know, just as Abraham realized who his guests were when they revealed the fact that Sarah was going to have a son in her old age, it was a revelation to Abraham that these men were angels. Lot had a similar revelation who his travelers were, and that they were angels because they were able to control the mob so easily that they took the threat away from Lot and his family by striking them with blindness. Then after asking about other family members, the angels told Lot of the Lord's intention to destroy Sodom, and they were to leave the next morning. We pick it up in Genesis 19, verses 15 and 16. It says, "When the morning arose, Then the angels hastened Lot, saying, Arise, take thy wife and thy two daughters, which are here, lest thou be consumed in the iniquity of the city. And while he lingered, the men laid hold upon his hand, and upon the hand of his wife, and upon the hand of his two daughters, the Lord being merciful unto him, and they brought him forth and set him without the city. Now, did something jump out at you at those verses when we read them? What caught my attention was while he lingered. Why would he linger, knowing that the city was going to be destroyed? The way I picture it is that his lingering was he was walking around his house and thinking, I've got all these things. How am I going to take all my things with me? Maybe I'll have to rent a cart or buy a cart and I can load everything on. Maybe I'll have to make two trips. And then all of a sudden the angel grabs his hand and says, Lot, you don't have time for this. None of these things are important. Your life is at stake. You have to leave now and leave everything behind. Now, Lot believed that Sodom was going to be destroyed, but he didn't have a sense of urgency for his own safety. He lingered. He hesitated. He thought about his possessions, and it could have cost him his life had it not been for the Lord's mercy. The next scene shows that same hesitancy in Lot. In verse 17 and 18, we read, And it came to pass when they had brought them forth abroad, that he, that is the angel, said, Escape for thy life, look not behind thee, neither stay thou in all the plain. Escape to the mountain, lest thou be consumed. And Lot said unto them, Oh, not so, my Lord. Behold, now thy servant hath found grace in thy sight, and thou hast magnified thy mercy, which thou hast showed unto me in saving my life. And I cannot escape to the mountain, lest some evil take me and I die. Behold, now this city is near to flee unto, and this is a little one. Oh, let me escape thither. It is a little one. Is it not a little one? And my soul shall live. Again, what jumps out at you when we read that text? The angel says, Escape for your life. Don't stay on the Jordan plain, but escape to the mountain. And Lot's reaction is, I can't go to the mountain, lest some evil take me and I die. Let me go to Zoar. It's just a small city. I'll be safe there. What had he just experienced with the angel? He was delivered from Sodom. He was with a being who knew what was going to happen in the future. He knew where danger and safety was. And yet he questions that, thinking that he knows better where safety is for him and his family. Well, one aspect of the story that we always come to is what happened to his wife. After Lot and his family arrived at Zoar, we're told in verse 24, Then the Lord rained upon Sodom and upon Gomorrah brimstone and fire from the Lord out of heaven. And he overthrew those cities and all the plain and all the inhabitants of the cities and that which grew upon the ground. But his wife looked back from behind him, and she became a pillar of salt. Apparently it wasn't just Lot who hesitated to leave everything behind. And maybe the Lord's punishment of Lot's wife shows that she influenced Lot in his decisions. Now, there are a number of theories about how the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah could have occurred. We have some very strong clues even seen in the area today. The scriptures say that brimstone was used. Now, brimstone is actually sulfur, and sulfur can be found in abundance around the Dead Sea where Sodom and Gomorrah are believed to have existed. Here's a picture of sulfur embedded in ash found near the Dead Sea. Another element found in the area that would make the destruction more than feasible is that bitumen is common in the area. In Genesis 14:10, we're told that the valley of Siddim, where the five cities were located, was full of slime pits. Well, the Hebrew word for slime means bitumen or tar. As you know, tar and sulfur are flammable. And a third element, even present in the area today, is that there is a major fault in the Earth's crust. Now, here's a world map showing the tectonic plates that make up the Earth's surface. The key principle in tectonics, plate tectonics, is that the upper crust of the Earth actually floats on the liquid-like layer beneath it. This layer beneath the crust is semi-molten, so there's great heat associated with it. Now, heated matter generally becomes more buoyant and it rises, and cooling matter sinks. So as this matter is rising and sinking, currents are set up in the fluid. And so the upper crust that is floating is actually moving and separating or coming together. These plates often grind against one another. San Andreas Fault is one an example of tectonic plates grinding against each other. These plates, where these plates meet, are generally areas of volcanic activity and earthquake areas, and sometimes mountains are formed by the upward movement of these crust plates coming together. Now, the particular area we're interested in is circled right here, where the African plate, the one in orange, meets the Arabian plate, the yellow one. Here's a closer look of the immediate region we're looking at. Notice the line where the plates meet. Go up through the Red Sea, up the Gulf of Aqaba, through Israel, then up into Syria, and then back down through Iran. This is the northern end of what is called the Great Rift Valley. In Israel, it forms the Jordan Valley, with mountains on either side. The Jordan River, the Sea of Galilee, the Dead Sea were all formed due to the depression caused between these two plates. Now, rather than grinding against one another, these two particular plates are actually moving apart. Now, geologists compare it to taking taffy and spreading it apart. If you take taffy and spread it, before it breaks, it gets very thin right in the middle before it breaks. Well, that's exactly what's happening right in the Jordan Valley, where the earth crust gets very thin. That part of the earth's surface actually sinks, and that's what's happening to the earth's crust in the Rift Valley. Here's a view, this next one, of the Sinai Peninsula from space. You can see the Rift Valley on the right going from north to south. The Rift Valley passes right through the area where Sodom and Gomorrah were located. Doesn't that just amaze you that God could set up the earth millions of years ago to be like this and know that something like Sodom and Gomorrah would be located right there where he could use natural forces that he created to develop his will for that area? Well, here's another illustration of what's happening in the Jordan Valley. The African and Arabian plates, like I said, are moving away from each other, and the valley in between is sinking. The Dead Sea is sinking even today, and scientists estimate that the Dead Sea lowers by as much as 13 inches per year. Now, on a geologic time scale, that is incredibly fast. Because of the sinking action, we know that the Dead Sea is the lowest spot on the face of the earth. As I said, the meeting of these two plates often causes earthquakes, and that's what probably destroyed the Sodom and Gomorrah and the other cities. There doesn't seem to be any significant volcanic activity in this area, so probably it was more associated with an earthquake. Now, with the abundance of sulfur and tar pits in the area, in an earthquake, pressure from beneath could have spewed the molten rock and sulfur and tar up into the air and then rained down upon the city, appearing to come down from heaven. There's also been debate regarding the exact location of these cities. There are at least three prevalent theories. One theory suggests that the cities are today under the waters of the southern tip of the Dead Sea, as you can see here. The southern end of the Dead Sea is partially separated by from the northern part by a peninsula you see about two-thirds of the way down. While the deepest spot of the northern section of the Dead Sea is over 1,000 feet deep, the southern end is very shallow. It's only 10 to 15 feet deep at its deepest part. This has led some scholars to speculate that at one time the southern end was not covered with water at all, but it was part of the Jordan Plain, where the five cities mentioned in Genesis were located. Notice how this map shows the cities would presently be underwater. Another theory is that the cities are located on the east side of the Dead Sea, on the Jordanian side, on a plateau where five archaeological sites, cities, have actually been found. This is a satellite view of the area showing the location of the five cities. Notice the northernmost site. It's a place called Bat Adra. Archaeologists found over 20,000 tombs that had been dug there. Some scholars believe that this is the biblical Sodom. In 1989, a man by the name of Ron Wyatt was examining some formations along the western shores of the Dead Sea. He claims to have found the picture we showed earlier of these sulfur balls surrounded by ash. And they were found at all five sites that he claims are the five cities of the Jordan Plain. Here's a map showing where Wyatt believed the cities were located. He located Sodom very near what is presently called Mount Sodom, and he believed that the five cities found on the eastern side of the Dead Sea were actually Moabite cities of a later time period. So you can see that theories abound. And maybe one of those is right. But the fact is the cities were destroyed. And maybe the uncertainty of their location simply suggests how thorough their destruction was. Even though there are natural reasons why this could have happened, it was still the Lord's judgment. It was still a miracle of timing. And the lessons are powerful to people who want to be pleasing to the Heavenly Father. Notice from the scriptural account that far more than two cities, the two cities of Sodom and Gomorrah, were destroyed. In Deuteronomy, the 29th chapter, the Lord is warning Israel to obey the law and not to walk after the imagination of their own hearts. And he says in verses 22 and 23, "So that the generation to come of your children shall rise up after you, shall say when they see the plagues of that land and the sicknesses which the Lord hath laid upon it, and the whole land thereof is brimstone and salt and burning, that it is not sown nor beareth, nor any grass groweth therein like the overthrown of Sodom and Gomorrah, Admah and Zeboim, which the Lord overthrew in his anger and in his wrath. Even all nations shall say, wherefore hath the Lord done thus unto this land?" Well, this tells us that there were actually four cities destroyed in the Jordan Plain. The fifth city, Zoar, would probably have been destroyed also had not Lot gone there. Though the locations of these five cities is disputed, when we look especially at the southern region of the Dead Sea, we have to wonder, how could this have been like the Garden of the Lord? How could this desolate area have once been lush and fertile plain where men could water and feed their sheep? In Ezekiel 16, 49, and 50, we're told the underlying reasons for the sin of the five cities. It reads, "Behold, this was the iniquity of thy sister Sodom. Pride, fullness of bread, and abundance of idleness was in her and in her daughters. Neither did she strengthen the hand of the poor and needy. And they were haughty and committed abomination before me. Therefore I took them away as I saw good." You can see that the sins were more than the abominations that they committed sexually. They were perverseness in fullness of bread, abundance of idleness, didn't help the poor and needy, and they were proud. It's a reminder to anyone who looks upon it of the importance that the Lord places on moral purity, unadulterated worship, and a humble view of who you are. Jesus used Lot as an example of what the conditions would be when the Son of Man would be revealed. In Luke 17, 28 through 33, after comparing his second advent to the days of Noah, he says, "In like manner also as it was in the days of Lot, they were eating, they were drinking, they were buying, they were selling, they were planting, they were building. But on the day that Lot went out from Sodom, it rained fire and sulfur from heaven and destroyed them all. Thus will it be in the day when the Son of Man is revealed. On that day let not him who shall be on the roof and his furniture in the house descend to take it away. And in like manner let not him who shall be in the field turn back. Remember Lot's wife. Whoever may seek his life, may seek to save his life will lose it, and whosoever may lose it shall preserve it." On reprint 28:57, we read, "We may consider ourselves justified in considering Lot and his daughters who escaped to be illustrations, whose antitypical lessons would apply to the present day. For as Abraham and his patient waiting represented the faithful, the overcomers, so Lot seems to represent a class in the end of the present age who do not walk sufficiently by faith and who seek not chiefly the kingdom and its righteousness, but who for the sake of earthly advantage are quite willing to risk their spiritual interests and the highest interests of their children by choosing fellowship with the world, by commingling to some extent with the world and the flesh and the devil. Such, the apostle tells us, shall be saved so as by fire. Such the Lord illustrates as coming out of great tribulation, washing their robes and making them white and eventually obtaining a blessing, but not the chief one." Well, the picture of Lot seems to fit very well with the great company attitude, doesn't it? His hesitancy to leave Sodom, the angels taking him by the hand and leading him out before Sodom's destruction, illustrate the dullness of the great company. Even after leaving Sodom, his desire to stay in Zoar showed that he still had a connection with city dwelling, that he felt more secure there. than where the Lord would lead him. And finally, we see Lot's wife turning back to Sodom. Now, the way Jesus described her might suggest that it was more than just a brief glance, like we sometimes think. He says that those in their house should not return to take back their possessions. And then he immediately says, remember Lot's wife. So rather than a quick glance back to the burning city, she may have actually turned back and was intent on saving some of her precious possessions. But brethren, look at the price she paid. No worldly possession that we own has any real value. Lot's wife lost her life because she valued those things. She wanted them, and she was willing to return to a burning city to get them. Think for a moment, brethren, if you lost every possession that you have, I know it would be hard, but what would it do to you in the long run? If that would devastate you, then remember Lot's wife and know that your real treasure lies in God and your spiritual life and nothing that you own. Lot's wife was turned into a pillar of salt. God intended that she become a monument to poor choices. She stands as an example of people who choose the temporal over the spiritual. Her heart had a total connection to the things that she possessed. Lot's heart had a hesitance to let go of those things, though he was able to finally when God took him by the hand. The lessons we should take from these examples is don't judge your success or happiness by the things we possess. Understand the Lord's judgments in the harvest, that they are just and good, and never hesitate to obey the Lord's will. And finally, never to put ourselves or our families in a spiritually compromising position. We are surrounded by temptations every day because these are the standards that the world uses to judge success. But think for a moment, who was really successful in life, Abraham or Lot? May the Lord help us all to focus on the true avenue to prosperity and wealth found only in God's ways.